Welcome to the Shepherd's Crook Podcast. This ministry exists to provide coaching, resources, and events for pastors and church members. My name is Jared Sparks. Join me as I talk pastoral ministry, applied theology like manhood and womanhood, political theology, and cultural analysis with a little bit of hunting and fishing thrown in. I'm a husband, a father, and a pastor, and I'm here to remind you of the chief pastor and our King, Jesus. Shepherd's Crook Podcast. Glad that you are back with me, and I hope you guys are having a great day today. Before we get into this live conversation, I'm in studio today at the church building with a good buddy, Keith Phillips, and I've been learning from him and excited about what he and his family is doing, and you guys are going to get to know him. It's going to be a lot of fun, this conversation, but I want to remind you of a couple things first and then pray. So Barbell Logic has been doing some wonderful things. They do online coaching for strength training if you are wanting to get in shape and you don't know what to do or what direction to go or who to get to help you to do that, then reach out to Matt Reynolds, Barbell Logic. They've got people that they can hook you up with when it comes to trainers, and online training, video training is, I think, some of the best training you can possibly get because you can go at any time. You don't have to fit your schedule in with a live trainer or anything like that. And when it comes to just strength training, these guys are the best of the best. And so if you want to reach out to Barbell Logic, please do that. Check that out. They've got a really good thing going on. I've been trained by Matt for a few months now, and I've been getting stronger, and I'm committed for the long haul. So small incremental gains, moving in the right direction, and that's what I'm excited about. So check out Barbell Logic. Also, I'm going to be talking more and more as we lead up to hunting season about Yukon River knives. You guys have heard me talk about Yukon River knives, but I want you to check that out as well. If you're looking for a premium knife that's going to last generations to come, that you're going to hand down to a grandchild or a great-grandchild, pick up a really quality premium knife, really great steel. I think it's that CV5 steel, so it's going to be able to last you multiple seasons without ever having to sharpen it until, you know, 10 years from now or something like that, and it's still going to be sharp. You're still going to be able to shave your arm hair, which is always my test for a good knife. Yukon River Knives, they've got the Hunter, and they've got the small game knife, and then the everyday carry knife that are really top quality knives. Christian company, it's a great company, check it out. Okay, Keith, how's it going, man?
It's going very well.
Good.
How are you?
Fantastic. I'm excited about the conversation.
It's good to be here.
It's a great Substack. I just finished right before you got here, right as you were getting here.
Yeah.
Finished the Substack.
Nothing like
the
last minute.
Yeah, I'm prepared, I mean, to the T. So
it's a very efficient what is it? Last second logistics.
Yes, exactly.
No wasted time.
Yeah, that's right. I was listening on double speed as well, so I'm good. We're going to pray, and very excited about this conversation. Let's go to the Lord and trust that He hears. So, Father, we just thank You for this time. Ask Your blessing upon this conversation. Thank You for Keith and his wife and family and everything that You're doing. Very excited to hear as we want to move away from consumerism and living a consumeristic life. We know that we're going to have to consume, but help us to be producers at the family level. Even as we encourage people within the church to produce more than they consume. We live in a world of people that are depressed, sad, lonely, angry, and all they're doing is consuming. And we need to light a fire under people with Your help to get out and work with their hands, get some calloused hands, and put their hands to the plow and see You do work. And we just trust that You're going to help us in this time and encourage us. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right, brother, tell us about yourself and your family and what it is that you do. And I found out from that Substack your grandfather was from Alabama.
Yep.
And I know you're not born and raised Southern Illinois, so bring us up to speed on how you guys got here as well.
Yeah, so the family basically, in my consciousness, started in Lower Alabama, Lower Mississippi.
L.A.
Lower Alabama, yep.
We were at Gulf Shores.
That's right. Yeah, I heard that on the podcast. Yeah. And you called it Mississippi, but I wasn't going to bring it up.
Oh, yeah. I call it Mississippi. Gulf Shores. Yeah. It's hard because it's, what is it, Mississippi? It's Gulf. There's a Gulf something.
Gulfport.
Gulfport, yeah. Mississippi. Gulfport. That's what it is, yeah.
I was born in Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Okay.
So that's between Mobile and Gulfport.
Okay.
And my father, my grandfather that I mentioned in the Substack actually moved at some point to, I think they lived in Pascagoula at first, which was near Ingalls Shipbuilding. They build Navy ships down there.
Oh, really?
And then they eventually ended up in Mobile County. But yeah, that was the story of how they got down there. On the other side, my mom's side, they moved from Spring Hill, Louisiana to Pascagoula initially for international paper. Okay. But then he moved over to Ingalls Shipbuilding as well. Both of them retired from Ingalls Shipbuilding.
Okay. Now, is that in the shipyard in Mobile? Because in Mobile, there's the USS Alabama.
Not in Mobile.
So it's not in Mobile.
No, okay, it's about 45 minutes or so to the west.
Okay.
And there was, I think it's still there, a Navy home port.
Okay.
So there's several destroyers and cruisers that's their home.
Okay.
That's their home base. But they build them there as well.
Okay, cool.
So one of the few places.
So that's where they met then?
Yep. And so, well, actually my mom and dad met at William Carey College.
Oh.
They both went to William Carey. My mom went there for a semester, or maybe it was a whole year, I can't remember. Got her engagement ring and checked out. So,
gotcha.
My dad stayed through. Initially, he got a degree in vocal, majored in vocal music, and then minored in business.
Okay.
Went to the theological, the Baptist Seminary in New Orleans.
Okay.
For a year, eventually, he took the advice of the counselor there and said, "Yeah, your ambition's way up here. Your calling's pretty low, buddy." And he was like, "Yeah, you're right." And he took off. And he's been in business ever since.
Oh, really?
Just retired from Ally Bank, which was GMAC. They rebranded post financial restructuring, GFC stuff, as Ally Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there for, it was right about 30 years.
Okay.
So had a great career there. Growing up, we lived in the suburbs and basically lived your standard American suburban life with restrictions. I talked about that in the Substack. You know?
Yeah.
So we weren't just like, you know, it wasn't one of those childhoods where I was allowed to just consume all the time and watch TV and eat candy.
You went to the movies 5 times, I think you said.
I think, yeah, like in my entire childhood.
Yeah.
Like maybe my entire adult life at this point, I've hit 6 or 7. I think the last thing I saw was Frozen when I was stationed in Korea.
Oh, man.
It's been a long time since I've darkened the doors of a movie theater. But yeah, everything was done in moderation. There was still a sense handed down that you're not going to be one of them. And we knew what that was. It was maybe somewhat judgmental, but it was good in the sense that it prepared us as children. We were not going to be just lazy bums that sat there. We weren't going to be obese.
Status child.
That wasn't happening. So we were still running amok. You know, there was enough woods in between the sections of the subdivisions that we were going to find places to be kids and build forts and get hurt and jump bikes over stuff that we shouldn't be doing, jumping and all that great stuff that kids are actually supposed to do.
That era was a great era to grow up. We were the last era.
How old are you?
I'm 40.
So me, I'm 41. Me and you are in this weird, that like sociologists have cut that like 80 to 84, I think, group.
Uh-huh.
Where it's like we grew up to a point of like full self-consciousness, totally analog.
Yeah.
But then we switched to digital early enough that we're native in both environments. So we're like neither Gen X nor millennial. We're like kind of our own thing.
We're the last generation that experienced awesome childhoods, basically.
We're daywalkers. You know, we can live in both. We had great childhoods.
Yeah.
And these computers came along and we were like, that's
destroyed everything.
Destroyed everything.
We're the last generation that rode bikes across town and showed up, you know, sometime late in the evening.
Sometime, right, exactly. When the lights came on or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, we moved around a lot. And it was a blessing and a curse. Like, I had to get used to making friends and being social, but never really got anchored in one place for that long.
Can I ask, now why is that? If your dad was with that company for that many years.
They moved him.
They moved him
They
around.
Moved him like crazy. They moved him more than the military does.
Really?
They stopped doing that at some point, actually post-restructuring, the great financial crisis stuff. His section of the business was doing well, but the real estate side tanked the rest of it, and so they got restructured, came out as a bank. Had to do twice as much work for the same amount of business.
Okay.
And all that when the government gets involved.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we moved around a lot. We were all over. And every time we moved, there was this glimmer of hope that I was going to get to have to live in the country. I wanted them to buy a place in the country, and they said they'd try. But they would go somewhere, and they'd be there for like 3 days maybe, and they would put an offer in on a house, and that's what we got.
Okay.
That's what we're stuck with.
But you were longing for the country.
I was longing for the country, and I didn't know why exactly, but, you know, reading Little House on the Prairie or whatever,
that's fun.
You know, books of yesteryear, I was like, I was born in the wrong century.
Uh-huh.
So finally, as an adult, actually in the Army at Fort Bragg, so I joined the Army.
Okay.
After moving around a bunch, I joined the Army and kept moving around. Lived in Germany for my first duty station, deployed to Iraq. From there, came back to Germany, got married on R&R from the deployment. And then my wife and I had 2 years of just blissful existence, really, in Germany to travel around Europe and kind of see things done differently.
Okay.
And there is as problematic as most of Europe is, there's a kickback against consumerism at least on its most crass commercial level.
Okay.
So that, you know, you go into a little town, there's no chain restaurant. There is a Gasthaus with a restaurant. So it's a guest house, you know, it's called a Gasthaus. It's Gasthaus, you know, whatever burg, right? Okay. And it's got a restaurant bar downstairs. It's got a Stammtisch, which is the locals' table.
Okay.
So you go in there on Tuesday. The same old guys are in there on Tuesday.
There's the popular table.
And you, it's a, yeah, it's invite only, and their steins, their mugs are hanging above the table.
Okay.
The same couple is running the place. They might pass on to their kids, or somebody else buys it, and they'll have one or two rooms upstairs that you can rent. So they're also, you know, for the night.
Okay.
So they're also innkeepers.
Mm-hmm.
That this idyllic village, to some extent, has been preserved in Germany, in these small towns. And so that gave us a different idea. Their Sundays, as secular of a society as it is, most everything shuts down on Sunday.
Wow.
Essentially, the blue laws are still in place.
Mm-hmm.
So at 4 p.m., I want to say it was 4 p.m. on Saturdays, like the mall would close.
Really?
Of course, this is, you know, however long it was ago, 20 almost 20 and 20 years ago, the all kinds of things closed on Saturday late afternoon.
Okay.
And did not open again until Monday, or at least late on Sunday. So restaurants were open on Sunday, and that's about it.
Okay.
And they were only open, you know, from noon or later. So there's nothing open in the morning on Sundays. And then on Sunday afternoon, just culturally, they would go walk. And there is a sense, probably because of the population density, much higher, but you walk through everybody's fields,
okay.
And that's okay. There's no trespassing and for farm fields.
You really?
And there's trails, right? There's
okay.
trails going everywhere, and people just go walk. You'll notice you drive down the road, and you're like, there's a whole lot of people just walking in the fields. So there are some cultural differences. You know, you've got the local bakery that you could go by in the morning and pick up this or that, or the Metzgerei, the butcher, to get local meats and things like that. A Getränkmarkt. Which is a drink market.
Okay.
So that's where you're going to get beer or Coke or whatever. It's a different situation.
Okay.
It's just culturally they've held on to some of that older variety of life, and they've pushed back against the just, you know, large corporations take over absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
That exists obviously, but it's different.
Okay.
So we came back to the States with this idea and this vision that life could be different.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that Germans drove really fast and lived slow. When you go to that Gasthaus, you sit down and they do not expect to use that table again for the rest of the night.
Okay.
Even if you come in at 5 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
they're going to expect you to not leave until 9.
Okay.
So there's no waiting for a table in Germany. It's just they're full or they're not.
Gotcha.
And if they're full, you're not getting one.
Mm-hmm.
Go somewhere else. So very different culture in that respect, and we brought a lot of that back with us to the United States. And I was always kind of wondering, like, what is it? I'm trying to put my finger on these cultural phenomenon. And there was a book that I read after getting out of the Army, and so another Army veteran friend had recommended to me. It was called Tribe by
okay.
Sebastian Junger.
Okay.
And, you know, Sebastian Junger, for all I know, he's a center-left to maybe a little more than center-left, materialist, secularist, who nevertheless has been a war correspondent all over the world. And one of the first things that he covered was the Siege of Sarajevo.
Good.
And then he went back in the years following and met the same people. And he noticed something very strange. They longed... Sitting in their easy chair now,
mm-hmm.
they longed for the days of the siege when they barely had enough to eat.
Really?
And they were playing cards around a pile of their burning furniture to keep warm.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Why? Why is it that occurs? Why is it that soldiers who are in harm's way and in these very intense situations depressed when they get home?
Yeah, and want to be back.
And want to be back, want to go back to it. Why is it that we have what I would sort of call the zombie apocalypse fantasy culture,
mm-hmm.
right? The movies, just the military-industrial zombie apocalypse movie industry,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's huge. And people long for what Paul, we were talking about earlier, to work with their hands and lead a quiet life with their family, their close friends. And really what modern culture has done is just a brand new thing in history where you've got where a massive amount of people, a huge portion of the population, has the potential to make quote-unquote wise decisions, work hard, invest a lot of money, and retire at 45 or 50, frankly. Almost anybody could do that. Most of us don't have the discipline to make the decisions, you know. Or even beyond that, be pretty rich. As much as has been made by, you know, what I would call the new right and a lot of the left about, you know, the working man kind of getting the shaft, that's only in terms of disparity. The, the bottom of the economic class has done nothing but go up during globalization. And that doesn't matter where you put it. There's a great book that I would recommend called Superabundance. And I think it makes a they're not Christians, but I think it makes a biblical argument that it's actually okay to have a lot of humans and have a lot more of them. And actually, the more humans you have, the better things get. But as things are getting better and better and better, and they're the novel thing they do is instead of using a sort of an inflation adjusted monetary metric to measure how things, I didn't mean that alliteration, by the way. it just comes out sometimes. Instead of using a dollar amount, they use an hour of unskilled labor at whatever that pay was. It can buy these things at this point in history in this place. So in Czechoslovakia in 1950, it's going to be a whole lot more labor to get a pound of sugar or a prepared meal than it is in Boston in 1950 or in Toledo in 1950. That number, what's it going to cost to get a prepared meal of this many calories, just continues to go down. Now, there's obviously some adjustments to be made for the quality of those calories in the industrial food system, but you just look at everything.
Unprecedented wealth.
What do we do with it? I mean, in the 1970s, we were talking about the population bomb, and I can't remember the names of the guys that, that were involved in this particular controversy, but you know, the guy that wrote the population bomb, leftist, people are bad, we need to go away because we're destroying the earth. Another guy, whose name eludes me, but great dude, makes a bet with him. And he's one of the few people out there willing to do this at the time. He says, I'll bet you $10,000 that in 10 years, everything you're saying is wrong, and it's going to go the other direction. The population is going to go up, and every single raw material and every single, you know, manufactured thing and prepared, all this stuff that you say is that there's going to be a shortage, and there's going to be riots and mass starvations, it's actually going to go the other way. Food's going to be cheaper. Metal's going to be cheaper. Everything we need is going to be cheaper. And he was right.
Spot on.
By a long shot. And what this is telling me as a Christian is that people aren't bad for the earth. People can be bad in the micro for the earth. We can be irresponsible. We can not be good caretakers of our environment. But by and large, we actually have a symbiotic relationship with the earth. And so we should not be apologetic about the fact that we are to multiply and fill the earth. We are to turn wilderness into garden. And we are to do it in such a way, and we will learn as things progress, in such a way that is beautiful and is good and works with nature and not against it. So all of those things to say, we're supposed to be here, we're supposed to be working, and our idea of the good life is not a life in which, you know, as John Piper famously talked about, you run around the world collecting seashells, just sort of purposelessly, aimlessly pursuing pleasure. And rather, we're supposed to be pursuing productivity, and we're supposed to like it. But we're in a situation where we've been taught not to. And so what I talk about in the Substack is like, how did we get there? How did we get taught to not enjoy work that Solomon told us we should be enjoying?
And
that
was the best we're going to do. Or only see work as a means to get to what
only
we enjoy.
To get to what we enjoy.
Well, let's get there here in just a second. I want to read a passage, and then I want to close out the first question I gave to you because I was still want to hear how you ended up in Southern Illinois.
Yeah, so that's right. I got off track.
He's a fellow pastor in town at Grace Presbyterian, and our
elder,
church
just
used
an
to.
Elder.
He's
just
an elder.
A ruling elder.
Yes, he's a ruling elder, and he they're at the church that we used to rent. So we have kind of had a relationship with Grace for the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. Because for 3 of those 7 or 8 years, we were actually renting their building. It was really, really a good thing. But listen to this passage. This struck me a few years ago when I was reading my Bible. In Genesis, I started over and got to Genesis chapter 8, going into Genesis chapter 9.
That's not where I expected you to go.
Okay, listen to this. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, shall not cease. And then the next verse, listen to this. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth.
Yep.
So the promise of the earth and its consistency and its abundance of resources and the consistency of weather patterns and all of that. And then the be fruitful and multiply command coming right after that. It's right after that. So there, as we are filling the earth and subduing it, there is an order that's in place, that's fixed, that's always going to be in place. And the command, bear fruit and multiply, fill this place. This is going to be constant. Therefore, fill this place. And that's always going to be the case until Christ returns. And just a neat passage that the global population, I think, is going to peak at like 9 billion. Before, have you seen that Peter Zahn's work on?
Yes.
Okay, so China's
huge
downfall.
Huge fan of Peter Zahn. Yeah.
Okay, so that his book, read that earlier this year. It's interesting where globalization has peaked and now is on massive decline, which I think coincides with what you're talking about here for massive opportunities to happen for
it is
things to be made here in the United States again. For even global shipping routes and everything like that to shut down. They're awesome opportunity, I think.
Absolutely.
Based on the things you're talking about.
And there's a massive wealth shift. Wealth transfer? Biggest wealth transfer in history.
Yeah.
As the boomers aging out.
The problem is with that is, it seems like, is that boomers are handing over some assets, but their wealth is not, the wealth is being spent. It's being given away to other places. But they are giving lands, properties, houses, and stuff like that. However, it does seem to be this disconnect with boomers as a whole. Most of them, there's godly boomers, obviously, but as a trend, they are not living to bless their children's children. They are giving it out. This wealth transfer, sadly, is happening some to children, to the millennials, but mainly, it's places like BlackRock. These people are coming and taking what the boomers have built.
It's bad.
It is bad.
And so I think we definitely need to I'll adjust that.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm still seeing the audio here. I kicked it, but it's all right.
Yeah, there's a lot of corporate takeover of land and farms and this, that, and the other. We need to be doing what they're doing. We need to be competing with them for that. Labor, as Peter Zahn points out, it's becoming a very, very scarce commodity. I think the only thing that is saving us right now from a pretty bad, bleak economic situation is the fact that labor is as tight as it is. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to have the foreclosures and so forth that you had before, because people aren't losing their jobs like they were before.
Okay.
2008, 2009, there were very loose labor market. Mm-hmm. And so when you lose your job, you lose your house. BlackRock now has your house, or it's Warren Buffett's
Company.
Berkshire Hathaway now has your house at pennies on the dollar.
Right.
So that would be bad. I think the tight labor market is blessing us in that sense. It's also causing us to automate.
Okay.
I'm not anti-automation, because I think the jobs that we automate generally are jobs that we don't need to be doing. I was just at the Homestead Festival at Rory Feek's farm down south of Nashville, and Joel Salatin was there, and he talked about Henry Ford, when he was giving a tour of his factory, said, my only complaint about this is that I have to hire a whole man when all I need are his hands.
Hmm. Wow.
So we, for some reason, and I think a lot of this is just political, populist baiting, a very shallow kind of thing, where we over glamorize the industrial era.
Mm-hmm.
Those weren't good jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They might have. It was the offer of consistency and this security and a pension and all this stuff. But pressing a button over and over again, industrial factory jobs, they're there. But if we can automate that, and we can automate burger flipping, we're not going to run out of jobs.
Yeah.
It will produce more jobs and I think better jobs. And because it's so efficient, we are also now the first generation, or one of the first generations, to go, you know what? Actually, I can use the fruits of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I can plunder Egypt a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can do my urban homestead,
yeah,
or my suburban homestead, or my rural homestead. And I can spend time with my family. I can raise my children in such a way that they are taught to love producing.
Mm-hmm.
And turn things around to an extent.
Yeah. Let me jump in real quick because I want to hit on a point before I forget and then jump back into this and just really let you lay out, because we've already been talking about some of the principles of the Substack that you've written. So have you heard of Newfounding, Nate Fisher, and what they're doing? Okay.
Yeah.
So they're doing some of the exact things you're talking about. They bought hundreds of acres, if not thousands, in Kentucky, building infrastructure right now to sell lots and land to people. And they're the ones that are saying, yeah, we should be taking over here. We should. We see the value in power. Christian men are the only people in the world built to handle power in a right way. And it's not inherently evil. It's power is turned evil by evil men. Power in the hands of good man is used for the good of others. That's the whole, the glory in it.
There will be a power vacuum.
And we need...
Something will fill it.
So savvy folks like yourself, and I think that's what you're talking about. And I'm not the kind of guy that... Everything I touch turns to gold. There are some guys like that that just know how to...
I'm working on it. Not there yet.
You're not there yet. But there's some guys that they could build a business, sell a business, make up a new business tomorrow and build that up for the next 3 years, sell it, and then come up with something new the next day. There are guys that are built like that. And we need Christian men that do that and gain and have for the good of others. And but for the run-of-the-mill guy, the average guy... isn't that kind of guy that can just start a business, sell a business, start a business, make another business. I'll just take, if I lose, if I go bankrupt, I'll just start another business. All right, doesn't matter. Most guys aren't like that.
No.
So what you're talking about is, I think, a practical vision for just the mindset that a Christian man needs. It's a biblical mindset about work that can give us the fortitude to keep going when things may not be going our way, but also... to instill some things in our children that will be able to grow up in a little bit different environment maybe that we grew up in. It sounds like you grew up in a similar environment that you want your children to grow up in. So I'm sure there's some changes that you've made. But why don't you just go ahead and lay that out. You got a Bible open. I'm interested to hear what you're going to reference there. And then lay out the Substack and what it is you're practically doing, because I think it could be practical for other folks as well.
Yeah, so let me just, if I can, I want to work backwards.
Okay.
And I'll go ahead and tell you ahead of time where we're going. We're going to Genesis 2:15, where God puts man in the garden to work it and keep it.
Okay.
Okay. So working, producing, keeping, protecting.
Edit. So working, producing, keeping, protecting. We're at 28 minutes. Just want to let you know where we're at. I want to keep it at under an hour if we can.
Yep.
So 28 minutes. Okay. Go ahead.
So yeah, working, producing, keeping, protecting. When we scrub the rust off stuff, when we re-oil machines, we are protecting. When we shoot invaders, we are protecting.
Mm-hmm.
When we tackle mountain lions that are attacking our children, okay, that's never happened to me.
Mm-hmm. But if it did, we'd be
But
ready.
If it did,
yeah.
You know, that'd be great. as long as I didn't die.
Yeah.
Or get completely maimed. So, yeah, we're protecting. We're producing stuff, we're protecting. We're cultivating, we're making our gardens to grow better. We're making that soil get deeper. That's where we're going. And my argument here is that is the default setting. Paul isn't restating that. He's understanding that that's the default because it's already there. I don't have to say it again, right? But I want to work through scripture a little bit to just make that point.
Okay.
So like if I go to Titus, for instance, and I'm not even going to flip there. I'm just going to believe it's Titus chapter 1 where he speaks about the Cretans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's actually, this is something like, you just can't get away with now. He's talking about a particular geography and a particular culture, a particular people, and he says their culture stinks.
Yeah.
Why does it stink? Because they even themselves, one of their poets has said, they are evil beasts, lazy gluttons.
Yeah.
So rebuke them strongly, rebuke them so that they may become strong in the faith.
Mm-hmm.
So he rebukes their laziness, their gluttonous behavior. And then, obviously, both in 1 and 2 Thessalonians, Paul refers to the idol, admonish the idol. They need to work. Mm-hmm. Ephesians 4:28, I believe it is, let the thief no longer steal, but work with his hands that he may have something to share with others. So you're producing more than you consume.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so the earth is put into a situation of abundance. That is the situation. That is a default setting that Paul is speaking from. And if you look in Ecclesiastes, I think Ecclesiastes sort of has I love Ecclesiastes. It's got the vision of the good life, and it also has a realistic expectation that that will not be completely fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying things like, there is nothing, this is 224, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil.
Yeah.
Not his, like, super rewarding, easy work. No, mm-hmm. his toil.
Yeah. Find enjoyment in the toil. Yeah.
Skipping down to 3:13. Also that everyone... Let me back up, 3:12 and 13. I perceive there's nothing better than for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. And also... Or also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. He repeats this refrain several times throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. And so, but the way we've seen work in the modern era is not as its gift to man,
mm-hmm.
but as the curse of God.
Right.
And we are trying to get away from it. And we're trying to get around it. And here's the kicker. Work, even in its cursed state, where it produces thorns, the earth produces thorns and thistles, and everything that feeds man is difficult to mm-hmm. cultivate, right? Requires a lot of work. Even in that state, that gift of work, cursed, is better than anything we will dream up for ourselves that tries to subvert that gift and it's the concurrent punishment,
yeah.
okay, for sin. We are best off in that situation. There's going to be a trade-off to everything.
Mm-hmm.
If we come up with replicators tomorrow that require us to press a button or say, you know, hey Siri, bake me a cake, poof, there it is, or give me a Ferrari. Sorry, I got to shut off Siri now.
Uh-huh.
We will become psychologically unhealthy.
Right.
So let's run back to Sebastian Junger. Nobody in the Coringall Valley had a cell phone. They had a sat phone, maybe for the company, one or two of them, right?
Okay.
But they weren't running around with their cell phones. Maybe to the extent they did have some stuff that they were goofing off with, but their life mainly was surviving.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they then leave the most dangerous place on earth at that time and miss it,
mm-hmm.
where their friends are dying, where they're getting shot at constantly? There's no potential to just go get rich and get away from it. They're living in the moment. They're present. They're working. They're surviving at that point. They're not on the producing side. They're kind of doing the protecting part.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very unmitigated, primal fulfillment of calling.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have these zombie apocalypse fantasies where we no longer have to care what our 401k has in it because it's gone?
Right.
Because we want to have an unmitigated relationship to our vocation mm-hmm. and to understand it in its simplicity. A friend of mine goes to our church. He had an Amish crew build a pole barn. And he said what struck him about them was that they were always working and never in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, regardless of their other flaws, and there are many within their culture, their enjoyment comes in just being together and doing work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they've accepted, and it's pretty successful.
Right.
They have about a 90% retention
mm-hmm.
in their progeny. To stay within that
and their
culture.
Work is well sought after.
And their work is well sought after.
We have Amish cabinets in our house right now.
Yeah. You know. And they hire other people to drive them places, and they don't see it as hypocrisy because they're not saying it's wrong. They're mm-hmm. saying we've chose this
we
to preserve our culture. We don't want
to
do that. And they end yep. up in this interesting sort of aristocratic position. Like, unless you're a colonel or higher in the army, or you're just very, very well off, you're generally not getting driven around by somebody.
Did you happen to listen to that episode I did a while back on in-group preference?
No.
Okay. So, but because I talked about
it. So there's out-group preference would be kind of the standard liberal. I'm better than the people around me because I understand, and therefore I'm going to choose this.
In-group preference would be the Amish life. It would be the Orthodox Jew. It would be the Islamic, you know, community where you're giving business and building business within, and you're preferring your group. And Christians have seen that as some sort of extra-biblical ethic. Whereas in the Bible, it's actually a strong, let us do good to everyone, especially those of the household of faith, you know, Galatians.
Especially is there.
And that's been something that I've admired about the Amish, is there is that strong in-group preference. And you see that even builds care for one another, and even though the work they're doing, they care about not only the work they're doing, but they care about the work that Ezekiel's doing, you know, building cabinets. He's not there building this barn, but he's the cabinet maker. They won't let each other fail. That's right.
And so why are they different? And I've had a lot of interaction with Amish recently, so I've had a lot of good conversations with them. Okay. But why are they different? And this gets back, kind of back to the Substack and the story here. You know, and the idea, I think, you know, Paul's default setting when he's speaking about work is this Ecclesiastes and Genesis 2 and Genesis 8. You know, this is what man's called to do. This is what you should be doing. This is breathing. I think I said, you know, evangelism is helping people escape Alcatraz of sin.
Mm-hmm.
You should not stop breathing when you do that.
Right.
You know, so this is just default stuff. It's not the gospel, but we can be so, we can be neglectful of the default thing and completely abandon any sense of legacy and future for the kids, right? So if the Amish are holding on to 90%, we're holding on to 10, which is what broad evangelicalism has done, something's wrong. Terribly wrong. They didn't have a vision of the future. Jesus is coming back next Tuesday.
Right.
And if that's what you think, and everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and nothing's going to be good, we're just going to be persecuted and die, even though really, if you look around, that's not happening.
Yeah.
You're not going to have institutions. You're not going to prepare the next generation. We're going to do evangelism to pull people out of the fire, but we didn't bother to build our own houses or maintain them. And that's a problem. We need to do both.
Yeah. Let me interject a thought real quick, because I think you've probably done some reading on this, and I think there is a natural connection with anxiety, depression, purposelessness, all of that, when you consume more than you produce and all of that. And you referenced earlier industrialism. And, you know, industrialism screwed everything up. I think a lot of people have recognized that a move away from agrarianism, you move people away from land, you disconnect them from, you know, aspects of purpose in life. Mm-hmm. So you make another man productive and you get some resources from him. But if you're making him productive and his property productive and not your own, then there is a great sense of loss, even though you might have more material wealth than before. And do you think that it is related, the disconnect from land, of why people are so miserable? I mean, I think it's the heart of where you're getting to, is that how do we get back to that when we are so ingrained in the way things are? Like, is it just a simple recognition of the things that you're talking about? Like, something is messed up, people are depressed, people are purposeless, we aren't preparing the next generation, or we're out evangelizing till our hair's on fire, but we're giving our kids to the state to educate them. Is it all of the above, all of those things together, or is it, how do you wake people up?
For me, what this project is it's providing a theological underpinning to make choices that people otherwise wouldn't make, to pursue a cultural liturgy that is going to inculcate a different vision of the good life and a different idea of what is pleasurable.
So that starts with you and your family and your friends at your church, basically. Yes. That's how it starts.
And then if anybody reads what I've written, I think maybe 4 or 5 people at this point have.
I have.
Then maybe we're up to 6.
Yeah.
Then maybe they'll be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Industrialization being and this is somewhat controversial, maybe. I don't think industrialization per se is the problem.
Okay.
But, you know, in this blip of history, this very small piece of history in which we've had industrialization and we've had excess wealth, we've had superabundance, we've not known how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the million-dollar question is, how do we move forward? Because we're not undoing industrialization. We're not doing post-industrial information industry.
I don't know. Peter Zahn, if it all collapses, and the
I think he's this is where I critique Peter Zahn. Do you know who David Bahnsen is?
Yeah.
Okay, so David Bahnsen, Greg Bahnsen's son, is one of the most brilliant men.
Yeah, he is.
Of this generation.
He's got some great concepts recently. I've been thinking about it, that you kind of are your work. It's not that's very much kind of very that is.
Hi, my name's Keith. My name's Bob. Hi. Yeah. What do you do, Bob?
Right.
Because I don't know who you are apart from what you do.
Yeah,
and if people understand the myriad of things I do, they'll understand why I have this sticker that my wife bought me on my coffee mug. ADHD.
Were you medicated for that when you were a kid?
I've never been medicated for it.
Okay.
I think maybe I have this idea that I'd become a superhuman if I was medicated for it, but I'm just fighting it for now.
Well, I was medicated for 27 years, and it wasn't all it lives up to.
No.
I wish I wasn't.
It's interesting. I've got a friend that's the pastor. You might know him. Is medicated.
Okay.
But it's like on off. Like okay. When he has to, right? I think. And the first time he told me about it, it was like, oh yeah, it makes you Superman. And the second time he's like, it's terrible, don't do it. So he last time I talked to him, he really backed off.
Okay.
So, gosh, where were we with this? We've got to make a transition, a paradigm shift, that allows us to live in the post-industrial world in a healthy way. I don't think it's going away, and I think that David Bahnsen is a very good corrective to Peter Zahn. I think Peter Zahn tells you the train is going 15 miles an hour. It left the station at 2:43 p.m., and it will impact the other train that left its station going the opposite direction at 3:15 at 3:42.
Okay.
Okay? And so what he's saying is true, and it's backed up by data, and the math works out. What it doesn't factor in is human agency.
Mm-hmm.
So China, as much as I think it is imploding, could make shifts that fix its situation a little bit, and it's not as bad as Peter Zahn might think. Having said that, being the top-down, you know, totalitarian state that it is, that makes it very resistant to helpful changes. So it might implode the way he says it does. In the West, within Western democracies, there's much, much more room for correction.
Mm-hmm.
And David Bahnsen, once a week, he puts out a thing called Against Doomsdayism.
Okay.
Very good to read and listen to. His various podcasts and stuff are just excellent. Can't recommend him enough. He may have actually already written the book that I want to write. It's called. I haven't read it yet. It just came out a month or two ago. It's called Full Time.
Okay.
It seems like it's very much in the same vein of what I'm talking about. You need to be working.
Okay, I need to read that and then have him on the show to talk.
If you can have David Bahnsen on the show, try to have him in person so I can meet him.
Okay. Well, I won't get him in person, but I'll track him down.
Absolutely.
And I'll get a hold of him somehow.
So David is a very good corrective to this, and I think that. It's not going to collapse. I think the shocks that we self-inflicted to our systems in 2020 were massive, and it's amazing that it performed as resiliently as it did. Mm-hmm. Why? Why did it do so? Because we've been on the right side of Hayek's knowledge problem, right? So Friedrich Hayek, the Chicago School of Business, essentially Austrian, but I guess they differentiate between Chicago and Austria. At any rate, one of the good economists, he said that the problem with communism is that the Central Committee cannot make a trillion decisions a day that are required.
Okay.
That trillion decisions a day need to be pushed out to the lowest level so that people that actually have the knowledge of what's going on at that granular level can make those decisions, and then the economy is much, much more productive.
Okay.
Oh, not only that, we're free, and last I checked, the Bible continues to call freedom a good thing over and over again. You have slavery and freedom juxtaposed, and freedom's the good one that you want. So we're supposed to be free. If we are free, we do better. We make the earth a better place to be, even if there's a gazillion of us. We actually make it better that way. And so I think that industrialism and post-industrialism, I think it does hold. And I think, and maybe C.S. Lewis has talked about this a little bit, that there's a re-enchantment of the universe, a sort of, not post-scientific, but maybe we would call it a hyper-scientific, where science catches up to theology mm-hmm. and philosophy, in which everything's re-enchanted, where we understand things to the point that we're not making the universe void of meaning mm-hmm. by understanding it at its granular mechanical level, but rather it gives glory to God. Mm-hmm. All that to say, I don't think it's going away. I think people that are urban are going to have to figure out how to have this mindset. Okay. I've seen some productive urban family stuff. It wasn't by a Christian, incidentally. And so it was very shallow. Mm-hmm. In terms of its backing, but there's some ideas of what they could be doing. I think if we just study history, what were people doing 300-400 years ago in cities? Let's see if there's something we can pull forward, at least in principle.
Well, let's just throw out an example of what we're talking about here. The rubber meets the road. Let's get the idea and give out some practicals, because you and your family are doing some very practical mm-hmm. things that many people listening could actually do tomorrow. I mean, they could literally yeah. reach out to you and say, Keith, I want to do this, and it's an Instagram message. And they say, help me get started. And they actually can do this and start working together with their hands, with their family, if they've got a family, and start having a productive, not just a side gig, but recognizing, okay, this is a part of what God has called me to do and who I am. I want to do this, and I'm going to start producing and literally produce more than you consume. You can turn the tide.
Yeah.
So tell them what you're doing and what, just as an example, other people could be doing as well.
So let me, I think I can keep within our time doing this. The story that I told in the Substack, kind of starting with my grandfather. Obviously, in different places in the world, the timeline doesn't work the same. Cities are going to be at the forefront of it. Rural is going to be lagging. For him, it was rural. It was Coleman County, Alabama. He was following old John, the mule. He was born in 1920. In 1940, he joined the Navy. The Navy recruiter said, why do you want to join the Navy? He said, I'm tired of following old John. It was a lot of work being on the farm. He worked at a sawmill as well, but the property he left paid his father to live there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It was a productive piece of land. The property that he died on, he had to pay it to be there.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in the middle is he went to World War II with a lot of other people, did some amazing things. He was in some horrific naval battles in the Pacific Theater, and these guys came back having earned a respite, okay? But what they were offered and what they took hook, line, and sinker was a promise of a different kind of life. Now, that promise had been there, but it was basically only open to aristocrats and then, you know, the robber baron, you know, industrialists. That you could live a life of ease, right? Mm-hmm. Other than that, you're going to work. It was kind of a far-off dream. All of a sudden, in mass, people are offered, you can only work 40 hours a week, and you can retire and have maybe a decade or two to just not do much of anything at all at mm-hmm. the end of your life. And in the meantime, you don't need to educate your kids. We're going to handle that for you. You don't need to do anything with your family except maybe mow the lawn, but you can farm that out too. Mm-hmm. And then in the evenings, we're going to provide you with entertainment that is pumped into your house, initially by the radio and then by on the airwaves on television and then cable and then ever-expansive opportunities for that kind of entertainment. And you can sit there and veg. Your food's going to be cheap. Your work week's not going to be, it's going to be shorter than anybody's ever had it before. It's not going to be long. And then you're going to have weekends, and they're going to have paid holidays and paid vacation, and you're going to go places. You're going to make long trips to go and be entertained and just seek pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, what happened in that time period? Dad is going to his work. Kids are going to different grade levels of school, which was an idea developed by Marxists. And then mom, initially, because there's a vestige of traditionalism, is going to stay home. However, She finds it so stinking depressing that by the 70s, I believe it is, we've developed some drugs to medicate her so that she has something to make her a little more sane in between bridge games and affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's a pseudo-traditionalism in which mom's just sitting there at the house cleaning it, mm-hmm. I guess, and then looking good and being involved in whatever kind of lady things that she's involved in. The children of the Greatest Generation, they grew up in this Pleasant Valley Sunday upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, this is meaningless garbage. They went to Woodstock. They took drugs. They went to Tibet. They looked for meaning in Eastern religions and this, that, and the other. And it didn't work out that well. And actually, in the end, they became quite conservative and voted for Reagan, right?
Mm-hmm.
But their conservatism was one that was very truncated, and it was one that basically just accepted consumerist side of capitalism, and really just put what their parents did on steroids, mm-hmm. right? And there's very few voices out there in the wilderness, like Wendell Berry, who's saying, no, it's bad, you're going to destroy culture and meaning and everything. But generally speaking, no one listened to him.
Yeah.
Right. So we get to today, and we've been doing this for a while. At work itself is just tearing the family apart. Eventually, mom goes to work too, right? So she's taken out of the home. We come back together to recreate. That's the only unifying thing. And by and large, now we have these little screens that we recreate on alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so the disunification, the disintegration of the family is complete. And we've been taught, without words, but only with actions, by a cultural liturgy, that that's what we're made for. Mm-hmm. That's what we're to do. We are to glorify ourselves and enjoy stuff forever.
Yeah, right.
Instead of to glorify God and enjoy Him forever, as He has laid out that we should do in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to turn that around. We've got to get back to it. So what are we doing in our family? We did not know why we were doing it for a long time, but we were always drawn to this more simplistic, let's go work with our hands, let's go do stuff. And by the way, this grates against the very person that I am with my little ADD brain that wants to jump from endorphin, you know, hit to endorphin hit,
mm-hmm.
as I just scatterbrain, go after every little thing, right? To slow myself down and say no, actually to weed this garden as much of an opportunity cost as it seems to me is good.
Okay.
It is right. It is true. It is beautiful. I think in the Reformed world, we have, especially in the modern Reformed world, we've neglected aesthetics. Aesthetics mm-hmm. tell us what to do when we don't know philosophically what to do.
Okay.
Because we've been taught what is good, true, and beautiful, and we just go with it. And Edmund Burke really talks about this in chapter 5 of the Thoughts on the Revolution of France. Everyone should read chapter 5 at least
okay.
of Thoughts on the Revolution of France. We need to be inculcated with a sense of what is beautiful and go after that. And if we see that something is not beautiful, even if we don't have all the worldview training and all the philosophical training and all the apologetics training on why that's not good,
uh-huh.
we at least sense that it's not good.
And
we can just go with it for the moment. So we've been sort of backfilling why we should be doing this stuff. So we have gone the agrarian route. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to go the agrarian route. I think it's the easiest philosophically, but I think there's other people hopefully that need to be filling in the gaps because I don't think it's practical. It's not going to happen that everybody does this. So there need to be other things where families are coming together in whatever that work is. We need to be pulling that. Work has to become, because it is the primal human calling,
mm-hmm.
it needs to become the unifying force of the family. If it doesn't, the family disintegrates and it becomes purposeless.
Yeah.
If there's no mission, there's no mandate, then what is marriage even? Mm-hmm. If the wife is to be a helpmeet, what's she helping the man do? Fulfill yeah. his own pleasures? Well, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, patriarchy looks a whole lot different when the matriarch is helping build an estate.
Yeah, that's good.
That all of a sudden doesn't look oppressive. That looks empowering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're talking about kings and queens here, then all of a sudden it's everything's seen in a very different light. And so that's the angle which we need to come at it from. But, you know, so what are we doing? We are roasting coffee. We are growing food to the extent we don't kill it. We're not very good gardeners. We are buying, training and reselling horses.
Okay.
We have two Airbnbs, so we are innkeepers. And one of those we built, it was a stick built. I actually bailed a guy out of jail. And he lived with us for 9 months. And I bailed the right guy out of jail. He had all the skills necessary to build a house. He had worked for a homeowner for like 10 years.
Okay.
Had a meth addiction. But he dealt with it better than most meth addicts have.
Okay.
He realized at some point that the only thing that can replace meth, which, by the way, is essentially a huge overabundance of pleasure in the brain.
Okay.
So that it blows the synapses apart where they can't fire anymore. The gap's too big in the spark plug. And you need a really big charge to bridge that gap.
Okay.
The only thing that can bridge the gap in a meth-addicted brain is hard work and exercise. Go figure.
Okay.
Right to man's primordial calling.
Uh-huh.
So, if I'm using that word right, I don't know. I mean really old first things,
got it.
Right?
Got it. It worked.
I hope it works. So me and Sherman go out there for 6 months every day and build this 16 by 20 with a loft cabin. And we dump $60,000+ in just materials and stuff into it. I use the tractor. It was the first thing we would use a tractor for.
Okay.
Backhoe and all that, dig the footings and whatnot. And we built it in such a way that it should not go anywhere.
Yeah.
So very well built. But if you were to pay somebody to do that, you're probably in the $120,000, $130,000 range for that cabin. The second one we did was when I got involved with Bunky Life, which is now kind of the primary, I would say, more externally, bigger picture thing. We make cabin kits that you can build with your friends and family in a weekend. That doesn't include the prep for the land or putting the roof on it and do the finishing touches necessarily, but the structure can be built. A pretty impressive structure can be built in a day or two or three on the biggest ones. And so we built that one. That was much quicker. We're under $30,000 all invested, and it brings in about $20,000 a year.
It's incredible.
So that's been a great opportunity for us. So just with our innkeeping, we get paid to be on our land. And we've got 52 acres that backs up to a national forest. It's a good-sized house, a six-stall horse barn, all this great stuff. So the house payment's not cheap. Now, the timing was a God thing. We ended up with a pre-COVID price and a post-COVID interest rate.
Nice.
It was a pain in the time because it took forever, and I was like, God, what, you've abandoned me. But he hadn't actually abandoned me. He set me up for success.
Yeah, let me interrupt real quick. You leasing that out for during hunting season yet?
I have not.
Okay, because that's big money right there. Can you promote that and lease that out?
You know, south of 13, they don't bring as much because the trophies aren't as big. We did have some trophy hunters come last year. They were actually the first people to stay in the bunker.
Oh, they were, okay.
And they didn't shoot anything. They saw tons of stuff, but it wasn't big enough for them.
Oh, really?
They were used to hunting up in the north. So, no, if you just want to come hunt, though, it's yours, brother.
Okay.
You so just bring.
I just scored permission to hunt right
here. You did, and I am too cold-natured or hot or whatever it is. I get cold really easy. So, like, most of hunting season, I freeze in place.
They make warm clothes.
I will need one of those jackets, one of those Milwaukee jackets or pants or whatever with the battery in it.
The electric? Okay, gotcha.
I'm really bad. I went through survival. So, I didn't even talk about the Army much, but I went through survival school, Survive, Evade, Resist, and Escape. And my team thought I was not going to make it.
Really?
Because at like 8, 9 in the morning, the sun's up, they're taking their jackets off, I've still got blue lips. I can't look bad. I am not good with cold. Okay, all that to say, our land is paying us to be there. We've done these my kids get excited about these projects. The latest project, which you can see on the Bunky Life Heartland Instagram, is a coffee shop, coffee roastery, farm store, whatever. It's with a kit called a cabana. So it's got these big doors that swing open on the front, and it comes with a bar that we've stained in polyurethane. It looks beautiful. Definitely worth looking at. And I'm going to put my coffee roaster in there. I've already got the 60-amp circuit, 220 circuit for that.
Nice.
I've got another pretty big 220 circuit if we ever add a bigger commercial espresso machine and stuff. But we're hoping that that's basically like a Saturday only kind of thing. We're going to sell beans, which I've already gone through Southern 7 Health Department to do that. And we're going to, which basically they were very accommodating. They're like, yeah, it's ultra low risk. You don't need to do anything. Common sense prevails. Amazing.
Yeah, that's great.
When there's less people in government, so there's not there's not a gazillion bureaucrats out there getting paid to go inspect, all of a sudden they become very commonsensical about things. Uh-huh. It's wild. Don't fund the government much. It's dangerous if you do too much. And we're just going to give away cups of coffee.
Oh, that's great.
Because if you sell a cup of coffee, all of a sudden you're a restaurant.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're going
to... you have a tip jar out there for people to
We might have a tip jar. But if they just buy beans, then that's good enough. And it's community building, right?
Yeah,
so the one time we kind of experimented with it, some old guys that we know came over and sat there for a couple of hours. We want to get that going again. We might also put another kit near it and fill it with books and be like a public-private...
Okay.
Or private-public, however you say it, library.
So how many kits are you going to end up putting out there? How many cabins are you going to have?
Right now we've got a Haven Ultra with a bathroom bunkie beside it. That's the Airbnb. We've got the cabana, and we're about to build soon as it comes out because we've got a new one coming out. It's going to be the biggest one we've done, probably the biggest one we'll ever produce. About 389 square feet.
Okay.
Because tiny house code is up to 400 square feet.
Got it.
You could theoretically bring everything we make up to tiny house code if you made the improvements, right? But the layouts generally meet those safety recommendations, right?
Okay.
So to go over that, we're kind of in a weird area. We probably won't do it. But 389 square feet, you can live in with a family if you want to. I mean, 389 square feet 200 years ago is considered a very nice house, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing that for a lady who is coming back to our church who is essentially a missionary. She actually has spent time in the Middle East as a missionary. And we're going to be hopefully doing a lot more outreach to international students, the university, and stuff like that. They love coming out to our house.
Okay.
Huge opportunity if you have an international student population near you. Most of them never see the inside of an American house.
Oh.
They're very receptive to hospitality. And one of the great ways that you can bring the gospel into it without just having to be really annoying is to just do family worship with them because mm-hmm. it's your tradition. And most of these people come from societies that have traditions. And so they respect you and you have a tradition. And they're not at all put off by you continuing in your tradition while you're there. And so it's really cool to do that and then have a Muslim man say, so what is this book and what's the difference? Pointing out a Bible and a hymnal. And then you get a 30-minute conversation that gets you right to the heart of the gospel.
So let's just say somebody out there has land. As soon as I get land, Lord willing, I'm calling Keith. And going to be getting a bunkie out there. So somebody has, you know, 2-3 acres and they have no codes, they can do whatever they want, or they've got 150 acres. How do they get a hold of you and start asking questions? Hey, I want to do something like this.
Yeah, so best place to start, heartlandbunkies.com. I'm sure Jared can put it in the show notes.
Yes, I will.
heartlandbunkies.com, that's our website. Most everything you need to know about it is there. And if you call the phone number, it's my phone. If you email it, it's going to go right to me. My wife might get it at some point, but probably it's me. And we can help you in terms of just telling you everything you need to know. If you read through the FAQs, that's a lot.
Okay.
There are a lot of things to think about, and one of the issues with the business itself is that the sales cycle is about a year usually from ideation to execution, because there's a lot of things to think through as far as how you're going to do it, how you're going to fund it, where are you going to put it. How are you going to clear this land? How are you going to get it ready? What kind of foundation are you going to use? Who's going to do electricity if you go on grid?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going to run water from? All this stuff. There's a lot to think about. And there's a lot of solutions. So definitely, if you're interested, call me.
Okay.
Heartlandbunkies.com. On Facebook and Instagram, it's at Bunky Life Heartland.
Okay.
Essentially, what I am is a marketing license holder for Bunky Life, which is out of Ontario, Canada, a small company. David and Carrie Frazier run it. They started it, and they've got a small factory there that produces these kits. They're all made out of spruce, and so they're very high quality. But a bunky in Canada, people know what that is. It's just shorthand for bunkhouse.
Okay.
And a lot of people in Canada, in Ontario in particular, they have a gazillion lakes. They've got a lake cottage, a cottage out by the lake. They go there on the weekends, and then when they have grandkids, it's no longer big enough to fit everybody, so they throw up a bunkie next to it so the grandkids have something to stay in.
Right? Yeah.
So and you build it together, so that process of building it together is exciting. Our kids are like, you know, they get very excited about the next build.
Yeah.
You know, what is the next project? Just like they get excited about, we sold those 2 horses, now we're going to buy 2 more, so we're looking for horses now.
Yeah.
Now that we've trained those up. The opportunity to build skills and confidence in kids and doing one of these projects is great. They're actually quite easy. Mm-hmm. If I was to spend money on something, I'd spend money on the foundation and the roofing, but do the kit yourself because it's actually quite easy, cool. But it builds skills and confidence in the kids. Where was I at? How do we get in contact? Yeah.
Here's the deal. I'll put all that.
Heartland, put it all in the show
notes. I'll put that in the show notes, and I'll put the Substack in the show notes. So absolutely. Anything that you found interesting, you'll be able to have access to, and I'll make sure that everybody gets that. So
absolutely. Cool. And for bivocational pastors in particular, pastors all together, but definitely bivocational pastors, church planters, call me. I will straight hook you up. Because what I want to do, if you're kind of into this agrarian thing in particular, and you're like, you know what, I'm going to move to this little town because I've got an aesthetic that being a bivocational rural pastor is not a sacrifice. It's actually a beautiful life that I want to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have just, you know, maybe a few goats to milk or a cow to milk, whatever. Or you're just going to have a good garden and maybe some chickens, some other stuff going on. We're going to make soap, or we're going to sell eggs. We're going to make jelly and jams and stuff from the raspberries you pick. You can create an on-farm stay experience that is off-grid, that you have possibly less than $10,000 invested, but certainly less than $15,000 or say $18,000, somewhere around there invested, that's going to pay you up to 100% ROI.
Mm-hmm.
I will hook you up. I want to support bivocational pastors. I think this is a great calling for them to be innkeepers. And in doing so, it not only allows them to make money, but they can offer hospitality that they could otherwise maybe not be able to do on their budget, and spend more time with their families and spend more time doing ministry because their property is now productive and it's mm-hmm. paying them to be there, and they can spend more time shepherding the flock planting churches.
It's awesome. Guys, we've been talking to Keith Phillips. Appreciate it, man. It's good.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again for listening to the Shepherd's Crook podcast. For more information, you can go to theshepherdscrook.co. Please consider leaving a rating or review on iTunes. And if you want to become a member of the Shepherd's Crook, please message me and we'll get you on the list. We hope you have a great rest of your day.